Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we are very honored to have an interview with our region's newly elected Congresswoman, Sarah Jacobs, whose district includes parts of San Diego and East County. She's had a dramatic first few weeks on the job, from the Capitol insurrection to an impeachment proceeding. She'll be talking with us about those experiences as well as her committee assignments and the latest news on efforts to pass a COVID relief bill, first up on our show today. Then we'll have some national news from Public News Service, including highlights from the impeachment trial, updates on COVID-19 vaccines, and more. On Green Scene, we'll have the outcome of supervisors' vote on a proposal to purchase and preserve land in El Monte Valley and Lakeside, an effort that's supported by over 2,000 signatures and more than 200 residents and tribal members who held a march last weekend urging supervisors to vote yes. Vaccines for teachers, first responders, and workers in the food industry will soon be available in San Diego County, and we'll have details on today's show. A proposal by Supervisor Joel Anderson to give police officers priority for vaccines has been shot down by the board majority that opted to continue giving first priority to seniors. Shirley Weber has been sworn in as California's first African-American Secretary of State. Hear who's running in a special election to fill her assembly seat, including her daughter, La Mesa Assemblymember Dr. Akilah Weber. The city of Santee has drawn controversy over a letter sent by Mayor John Minto and approved by 4 out of 5 council members. It calls on Supervisor Nathan Fletcher to resign and apologize for remarks he made about organizers of the effort to recall Governor Gavin Newsom. Hear how Fletcher responded and why some Santee residents are accusing the council of hypocrisy for its criticism of Fletcher's remarks on white supremacy, given the city's long history of racial tensions. From California News Service, hear about efforts to prevent future rolling blackouts by utilities. We'll also have information on a bill by Senator Brian Jones seeking to punish porch pirates, or package thieves. Plus, hear about efforts to provide food justice to Californians in need. This is Love Your Heart Month, and we'll have some heart health information for you from the county on today's show. The Helix Water Board will be voting Wednesday on changing its meeting time back to the early afternoon. Find out why later on today. California State Park campgrounds have reopened, and we'll have details on where you can go camping locally. And finally, we'll end our show today with one of our Best of East County episodes, taking you on the road to Julian for the town's famous fiddling competition. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, and it's our great honor today to have with us our brand new Congresswoman, Sarah Jacobs. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, well, we're here to talk about that really uneventful first month that you've had back there in Congress.
Yes, not exactly the first month I had anticipated for myself.
I can imagine. Well, I mean, I have to ask, what was it like to be back there as a freshman congressional member, in the midst of the Capitol insurrection, the attack on the U.S. Capitol that occurred on January 6th?
So I was in the House chamber in the gallery, which is the balcony that overlooks the House floor. Normally, members of Congress don't sit up there, but because of COVID, they were distancing us. So I was one of about 20 or 30 members who were up there, and I'd been so honored to be chosen as one of the members to sit there during the opening of the proceedings. And I remember getting some alerts on my phone that some of the buildings were being evacuated. And my parents texted me, starting to see stuff on TV, on the news, very worried. And
it must have been terrifying for both for you and for them.
Yeah. And I texted them back, don't worry, I'm in the House chamber. It's the safest place I could be. But it turns out I was wrong. So we heard the mob behind us. We could hear the gunshot.
Wow.
We ended up having to hide under our seats to put emergency evacuation hoods on that are basically gas masks, and ended up evacuating, having to climb over chairs and under railings.
Wow. And yeah, we've since learned that some of the insurrectionists were communicating with each other on walkie-talkies, talking about gassing members of Congress in the tunnels that were being used to evacuate them. So it's really chilling. This was far beyond a protest, obviously, over, you know, objections to how the voting turned out in the presidential election. So one of your first acts in Congress, your very first House speech on January 13th was to call for the impeachment of then President Donald Trump. Can you tell us your reasons for that?
Yeah, as soon as I got back to my office from the safe room on January 6th, I talked with my team and decided to call for impeachment. My background, as you and many of your listeners know, is working in conflict settings, working actually on post-coup transitions. And I know from that experience that you have to hold accountable anyone who encourages, incites, or commits an act of violence at the first time it happens, or right, else you're much more likely to get future incidents of violence. So I felt like it was very important that we held Donald Trump accountable for what he did and impeached him. And I'm very glad that we were able to do that.
Yeah. You also have a resolution calling for censure of Marjorie Taylor Greene, the new congresswoman who, among other things, was tweeting and posting calls for the assassination of Speaker Pelosi and other members of Congress.
That's right. I think it's important that we hold Marjorie Taylor Greene accountable as well. I'm glad that we voted to remove her from her committees. I think that this, her behavior, her actions, her rhetoric goes well beyond normal political disagreement into the area that is simply unacceptable when you are a public figure. And so I think it's important that we show officially on the record with a formal House censure that this is not appropriate behavior by a member of Congress.
Okay. Another of your early votes was for a budget resolution that should make it easier to pass a COVID-19 relief bill. And I will say, when I've been asking our readers and listeners, what should we ask, you know, a member of Congress I'm going to be interviewing, everybody wants to know, what's the status on the COVID relief? Who can expect to get relief checks and when? So what do you know about that?
All very good questions. So there's two parallel tracks going on right now. So there is a track where we're working on trying to negotiate a bipartisan bill that would be able to get 60 votes in the Senate and be filibuster proof.
Mm-hmm.
Those negotiations are not going that well, truthfully. Mm. And simultaneously, we're working on a budget reconciliation bill that would only need 50 votes in the Senate, but somewhat constrains what we're able to do because it has to pass a series of tests to make it eligible for budget reconciliation.
Right. So that means that it could be passed with Democratic votes only if need be. What are the constraints? What can you not do in that bill that you could do if you had a few Republican votes?
So the major constraint is that anything you do in a budget reconciliation bill has to be its primary purpose having an effect on the budget. So you can't do anything that's considered policymaking that doesn't have a budgetary impact. And even if it has a budgetary impact, but the primary purpose is policymaking, that would not necessarily be eligible. And many of you have probably heard that there is currently conversation going on as to whether or not some things like raising the minimum wage would be considered eligible for budget reconciliation. And that will be something that the parliamentarian will have to rule on.
Right. So that might have to be considered separately. What about the $1,400 relief checks that President Biden has been pushing for, which, of course, is on top of the $600 relief checks that already went out or were approved under the Trump administration?
Yes. So this week and next week, the House is doing our markup of the budget, and then we will send it to the Senate, and then they will do their process and vote on it. So we're hoping to get this done as fast as possible. And these checks are part of what's being negotiated mm-hmm. right now. I personally think we should send as big a check as possible to as many people as possible. We know folks are really struggling. And mm-hmm. as we look at a place like San Diego with the high cost of living, you know, it's clear that many people need much more assistance than just $1,400. But it's a good start. Mm-hmm. It's important. And I'm hopeful we'll have that anyone who received a previous check will be eligible to receive this check as well.
Well, that's good. A lot of people have been asking about the small businesses and whether what is in the relief package, if anything, to help the small businesses that have been really struggling with the shutdowns.
Yes, we know. And I actually, when I was back in district 2 weeks ago now, I mm-hmm. toured a number of small businesses and talked with folks about what they're going through. We're working to include expanded PPP, more support through the Small Business Administration, also streamlining some of the rules, making sure we're actually getting that money out to small businesses with the right kind of oversight that we need. So I'm hopeful that all of that is going to end up in the final package. And I know our Small Business Committee is working really hard on that right now.
Very good. You are also co-sponsoring the Paycheck Protection Act for Women, which originally was introduced by Susan Davis, who, of course, held this office before you did. What do you think the odds are of it finally passing now that, you know, control of the Senate has flipped?
You know, I definitely think it's going to pass the House. We have a lot of support, and I know it's something that a lot of people feel very strongly about. I'm hopeful we'll get enough Republicans on board that it will be able to pass the Senate without a filibuster.
Super. And for those who may not be familiar with it, what's the thumbnail description of what the bill would do?
Basically make sure that women are paid equally for their work.
Hard to believe in the 21st century, we're still arguing this over 100 years after we got the right to vote, isn't it? We should all be paid equally.
Really?
You have snagged some pretty major committee assignments, including the House Armed Services Committee that Susan Davis used to serve on, as well as Congressman Hunter, our two East County former representatives, and also the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, among others. Tell us how that's going and if there's anything, you know, any key goals or legislation moving through there that you think our audience should know about.
Absolutely. I'm deeply honored that I was appointed to these two committees. They're very prestigious and we've got a lot of work to do. On foreign affairs, my main priority is working with the Biden administration to rebuild America's standing around the world and making sure that as we're doing that, we're doing it in a way that actually addresses the challenges we're facing right now and in the future, and not just recreating the alliances and institutions that we had in the past. And on armed services, I sit on the military personnel subcommittee, and I will be working primarily on child care for military families and addressing childhood poverty among military families, which, if we're able to address, will actually go a long way in reducing our childhood poverty in San Diego County.
Very good. It's just shocking that, you know, the families of our military men and women, many of them are living below the poverty threshold. I think a lot of people may not be aware of that.
That's right. And even before COVID, there were about 39,000 members of military families who visited the food bank every single month.
Wow. Speaking of people in need, I understand that on your last visit here, you met with local advocates for the homeless, including homeless people who are living along the San Diego riverbed. What's in the works to help them?
Yeah, so I visited the San Diego Riverbed and the really innovative partnership that the San Diego River Foundation and PATH have formed to work together to help people who are experiencing homelessness and living unsheltered in the riverbed, both as a humanitarian issue and also as an ecological issue. Mm-hmm. So we're working to make sure that in this relief package, there is rental assistance and homeowners assistance, that we're extending the eviction moratorium and keeping people in their homes. And also that we are creating more supports to organizations that are serving people who are experiencing homelessness. And then we'll be working more on further legislation to address the homelessness crisis in San Diego and across our country.
Very good. Back to budget issues for just a moment. We've heard a lot of big plans from Democrats on ways to help a lot of people. Obviously, some of those come with pretty big price tags, but What are your thoughts about, you know, if we don't want to just build, grow the deficit forever, what are some ways that you might envision to bring more revenue in or cut expenses somewhere else to help address the fiscal concerns?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's really important to say that the most important thing we can do for our economy right now is spend the money we need to spend to get through this crisis and stimulate our economy. Because as we saw in 2009, if we don't do a big enough stimulus, we'll actually end up with a bigger deficit because of the sluggish growth and therefore lower tax revenue base that we'll have.
Yeah, or businesses close, then they're not paying, you know, sales tax or income tax revenues and so forth.
Exactly. But I also think that we need to reverse the 2017 Republican tax bill that gave a tax giveaway to people who didn't need it and added trillions to our deficit without growing our economy. So,
and we're talking what, millionaires and up on that. Is that correct?
Or
Yeah. So it's not, the average person is not going to be affected by that.
So, although we do also want to work on repealing the cap on the SALT deduction that was in that bill, which I know is affecting so many San Diego families.
I'm sorry, which deduction?
The state and local tax deduction.
Oh, okay. All right. I think we've covered all of the questions that I came in with, Congresswoman. Listeners, if you tuned in late, we're speaking with Congresswoman Sarah Jacob, our newly elected representative, whose district includes not only San Diego, but much of East County here. What else would you like our audience to know that I haven't specifically asked you about today?
Well, I think the main thing is that I know that this last month and this last year has been really difficult for a lot of people, and it's hard to see a way out. I'm heartened that vaccine distribution is continuing to ramp up and that we will soon be able to get lots more vaccines distributed. And, you know, I know that watching the violence on January 6th for a lot of people was really difficult. And so everyone should make sure that you're doing what you need to do to take care of yourself, that you're talking to someone if you need to, but also that you all should know that I will be working every single day, every single hour, making sure that while this is our present, this will not be our future. And we are going to get through this. We are going to come out on the other side, and we're going to build the future that we all want together.
Very good. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule back there in Washington, D.C. to join us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times.
Our friends must work to answer all of the overwhelming, detailed, specific, factual, and documentary evidence we have introduced of the president's clear and overwhelming guilt in inciting violent insurrection.
Since former President Donald Trump is not testifying at his trial, House Impeachment Manager Jamie Raskin posed questions he hopes Trump's defense lawyers will answer about the president's behavior.
Why did President Trump not tell his supporters to stop the attack on the Capitol as soon as he learned of it? On January 6th, why did President Trump not at any point that day condemn the violent insurrection and the insurrectionists?
Yesterday, the prosecution largely focused on rioters saying how the president encouraged them to attack the Capitol. Representative Ted Lieu of California and other impeachment managers also highlighted the former president's lack of remorse and potential to do future damage if Trump can run for public office again.
You know, I'm not afraid of Donald Trump running again in 4 years. I'm afraid he's going to run again and lose, because he can do this again.
Trump's defense has 16 hours to present their case, with the Senate meeting through the weekend. A vote could happen as early as Sunday. While a recent Washington Post and ABC News poll showed a majority of Americans want Trump held responsible and barred from holding office in the future, more than half the Republican respondents said Trump bears no responsibility for the Capitol attack. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports about 120 former GOP officials met over Zoom last week. They strategized over how to rally whatever anti-Trump momentum is left in the party. About 40% support the idea of creating a new center-right party, though most said they wanted to stay with GOP. Last October, Trump may have been sicker with COVID-19 than was previously revealed. Two people familiar with his condition told the New York Times that officials thought at the time he would need to be put on a ventilator. When President Joe Biden visited an NIH lab yesterday, he voiced frustration about the lack of information his transition received about the COVID-19 vaccine supply.
We thought, and we were led to believe, there was a lot more vaccine available than there was.
Speaking through a mask, Biden said the coronavirus vaccine program was in much worse shape than he expected before taking office. When asked, Biden said he expects the country may not have vaccines for every American until fall.
We're going to be in a position where it's not going to be by the end of the summer.
During Biden's speech at the NIH, he reiterated how the $1.9 trillion relief package would support vaccine distribution. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released an updated forecast yesterday, projecting a $2.3 trillion deficit this year. While this figure is less than last year's record-high $3 trillion deficit, it is still the second highest since World War II. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Ross-Bratellum. Thanks for listening.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. San Diego supervisors voted unanimously on February 10th to purchase 98 acres in El Monte Valley from the Helix Water District and preserve the land for public use at a cost of nearly $3 million for the land alone. The action came after over 2,000 people signed a petition urging support for the land acquisition and after 200 or so lakeside residents and tribal members held a march the Saturday before the vote to urge that the land be protected. The proposal to buy the land was originally introduced by Supervisor Diane Jacob before she left office due to term limits. Supervisor Joel Anderson, East County's newly elected representative whose district includes Lakeside, initially voiced concerns over the cost and disrepair of some facilities on the site. But after the majority of the board and all public commenters voiced support for buying the land, Anderson ultimately not only voted for the land purchase, but also pushed his colleagues to support some $6 million in additional funds to repair dilapidated ball fields and restore habitat on the site along the San Diego River. Some residents feared that if the county did not buy the land, Helix Water could sell it at the valley's entrance to a sand miner. Helix previously sold another parcel in the valley that is now proposed for sand mining over the objections of valley residents. During the hearing, Anderson grilled staff over the price, which he noted was much higher per acre than a Star Ranch property in Campo also proposed for county acquisition as open space. Anderson also objected to county taxpayers being asked to clean up rundown facilities and suggested that Helix should dedicate the land for public use. He then made a motion before any public comment to not purchase the property and instead ask staff to identify other sites to purchase for public use at a cheaper price. That motion was seconded by Supervisor Jim Desmond. 13 people spoke during public comments, all in favor of buying the land at the entry to El Monte Valley. Judy Shore, who started that online petition, objected to Supervisor Anderson sending a press release out the night before the hearing announcing his position. "I thought the process on issues coming to a vote was to first allow public to weigh in on the subject," she said, adding that the board should buy the land to protect it from inappropriate development. She said the land in El Monte Valley is more accessible to the population than Star Ranch and that the cost was justifiable. Robin Bodecker, who owns a ranch in El Monte Valley, said its trails for hikers and horseback riders should be preserved for residents and visitors. She voiced concern that sand mining operations could threaten the health of residents and adversely impact the aquifer, or water table, on which residents rely for their well water. Joan Embry-Pillsbury, who many of you may remember as the former Goodwill Ambassador for the San Diego Zoo, owns a ranch in the valley and an equestrian facility nearby on 23 acres of that 90 acres up for sale. She said the land needs protection now, adding, "This could be our last chance to save it." Kenny Ramos from the Barona Band of Mission Indians said this land is important not just to my tribal nation culturally, but to all of us who live here in Lakeside. He urged preservation for Native and non-Native people to enjoy the land. Terry Bingham said that during the pandemic, public spaces have become even more important than ever. She likened El Monte Valley to Yosemite Valley, and both do have landmark mountains known as El Capitan. Robin Reardon, executive director of the Lakeside River Park Conservancy, warned that if the county does not buy this land, it would go on the open market, and groups such as the River Park Conservancy and the Kumeyaay Degaño Conservancy could be shut out of the process, unable to raise funds fast enough to buy and protect the land. Reardon confirmed that the site does contain many endangered and threatened species, and she offered to provide a list. Chairman Fletcher thanked all of the callers who testified remotely due to COVID-19. He reminded everyone that the vote by the prior Board of Supervisors had unanimously agreed on acquiring the land in concept. "I continue to believe this is an important component of a broader effort around preserving open space," he said, noting the site's importance as part of a regional trail system along the San Diego River. And he added, "I also appreciate and respect how important this is to our tribal community and our tribal partners in the Kumeyaay." Supervisor Tara Lawson-Reamer said, "I'm inspired by this outpouring of public support." And she added, "I do very much want to thank the residents of Lakeside and the Kumeyaay Nation for their enduring commitment to preserve and protect the El Monte Valley, which is one of our county's true hidden jewels." She then motioned to approve the acquisition. The motion was seconded by Supervisor Nora Vargas. Supervisor Anderson agreed to withdraw his earlier motion, provided that his colleagues would agree to find funding for an extra $6 million to fund restorations and avoid having the property be a blight. "If we're going to do it, and you all feel so strongly about it, we should be fully committed and finance the whole thing," Senator Anderson said. Chairman Nathan Fletcher agreed to bring this item up at the next board meeting and to support Anderson's proposal to fully fund restorations. Fletcher said, "Today I think it's important that we move forward with the purchase and that we rapidly get to work on making sure the commitment of the promise is fulfilled." Supervisor Lawson-Reamer also expressed her commitment to work with Anderson to find funding sources, telling him she would chase down that money and bring it home to your district. Her motion to purchase the 98 acres was then passed unanimously. The community's overwhelming support and Supervisor Anderson's shift to not only vote for the acquisition he initially opposed, but also secure pledges to fund restoration for the property, shows that our democratic process is alive and well at the local level. Verona Tribal Member Bobby Wallace, a co-organizer of efforts to save El Monte Valley along with Lakeside resident Billy Ortiz, posted on Facebook after the vote, "We made a difference for all people, the ancestors and the El Monte Valley San Diego River. Thank you, everyone who was there, and prayers from those who couldn't make it. It was you that made a difference."
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
San Diego County health officials said Thursday that vaccinations of teachers, law enforcement, and other essential workers will likely begin within 2 to 3 weeks. At the county's weekly briefing on the pandemic, Supervisor Nathan Fletcher said that if vaccine shipments continue at recent levels, virtually all residents 65 and older who want a vaccine will have received one. He said, "I feel very confident it will be in the next 2 to 3 weeks at the latest that we will be able to move into the next tier. That tier includes people in emergency services, such as police and firefighters, as well as child care and education workers, food and agriculture employees. After that come other essential workers and then residents aged 50 to 65. Asked when the over 50 group could expect to be vaccinated, Fletcher said it would be in the coming weeks, not months, but he stressed that he could not be more specific. He said the county is optimistic that the supply of vaccines will increase significantly in early March and continues to open new vaccination sites in preparation. For now, however, the county's vaccination efforts continue to focus on seniors. Fletcher says, "Our seniors constitute the vast majority of COVID deaths, so the supply of vaccines that we have is dedicated towards saving lives." Now, as of Thursday, according to the official vaccination dashboard, the county has been shipped over 703,000 doses and administered over 551,000, with 95,000 residents fully vaccinated after two doses. Fletcher said the county is being careful to honor appointments for second doses. "As new vaccines come in, we honor second dose appointments first," he said. President Joe Biden announced this week that his administration has secured purchase agreements with vaccine makers for enough vaccines to fully vaccinate 300 million Americans by July at the latest, or nearly all of the nation's population of 323 million Americans. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
By a 3-2 vote, county supervisors this week shot down a proposal by Supervisor Joel Anderson that would have given law enforcement officers priority to receive COVID-19 vaccines immediately. Anderson posted on Twitter, There are over 4,000 local law enforcement officers routinely called to respond to emergency calls, many requiring medical attention. Police and sheriff officers are often first on the scene at injury accidents, violent crimes, and drug overdose incidents. For example, all situations where officers may provide life-saving medical treatment. In a letter to the supervisors, the San Diego County Deputy Sheriff's Association states that last year, county law enforcement responded to over 10,000 medical aid calls. The letter adds that outbreaks at law enforcement agencies locally have resulted in staffing shortages and longer response times, impacting public safety. Supervisor Jim Desmond voted with Anderson in favor of the measure, while Supervisors Nathan Fletcher, Tara Lawson-Remmer, and Nora Vargas voted against it. California guidelines do give counties flexibility on who should be prioritized to receive vaccines, and some counties have included police officers. But Fletcher told KUSI on January 28th, "We are presently following the guidance, which is to do healthcare workers and individuals 65 and older." First responders, including law enforcement and firefighters, are next in line after seniors age 65 and up under the state guidelines, so they will likely receive vaccines in the near future, but not ahead of elderly individuals or frontline medical workers. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
Former Assemblywoman Shirley Weber has been sworn in as California's Secretary of State, the first Black woman to hold the office. Governor Gavin Newsom stated that Secretary Weber will be at the helm of California's elections, defending and expanding the right to vote for all Californians. A special election to fill the 79th Assembly District seat will be held April 6, with several candidates in the running. The top two vote-getters will advance to a runoff election to be held in June. Secretary Weber has endorsed her daughter, Dr. Akila Weber, to fill her Assembly seat. Dr. Akila Weber has received the overwhelming endorsement of the San Diego Democratic Party, with over 97%. In the heavy Democratic district, she has the clear advantage over other contenders. Akila Weber is a La Mesa City Council member and medical doctor at Rady Children's Hospital, where she founded the Pediatric and Adolescent Gynecology Division. She's also an educator, serving as an assistant clinical professor at UCSD. In La Mesa, she has worked to create a task force on homelessness and a police oversight board, implement a climate action plan, and protect public health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Weber's endorsements include Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins, La Mesa Mayor Mark Arapastathis, Labor Leader Dolores Huerta, and California State Treasurer Fiona Ma. On her website, Dr. Weber says, quote, "The COVID-19 pandemic has placed a spotlight on many of the disparities that exist in our society, including access to good health care, equal educational opportunities, continuing racial injustices, and economic disparities. I am running to continue the fight to truly eliminate these disparities and improve the health of our families, the health of our community, and the health of our democracy." Other candidates who have pulled papers to run but have not yet completed their candidacy filings as of our show taping deadline include Democrat Leticia Muniker, a labor leader, Aramike Blake Glass, a progressive racial justice activist, Shane Parmley, a teacher and organizer, Marco Contreras, a Republican with an economics background, and John Moore, a Republican and retired businessman. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
The Santee City Council voted 4-1 this week to condemn Nathan Fletcher, chair of the County Board of Supervisors, for divisive language referring to backers of efforts to recall Governor Gavin Newsom. The criticism stems from comments made by Fletcher in a Zoom call with Democratic Party leaders after the violent Capitol insurrection in Washington, D.C. Supervisor Fletcher stated, "There is substantial evidence that those who are leading this recall effort are linked and associated with neo-Nazi, with white supremacists, with right-wing militia groups, and we cannot stand for this here either," the San Diego Union-Tribune reports. Fletcher did not criticize those who signed the recall petition, focusing on the movement's leaders. A letter signed by Santee Mayor John Minto and sent to the supervisors states, "Hate has no place in Santee. Hateful rhetoric has no room in political discussions." The letter calls for Supervisor Fletcher to not only publicly apologize to the more than a million people who signed the recall petition, but to also resign from the Board of Supervisors. Santee's 5 council members are all Republicans, although one member, Santee Councilman Ron Hall, abstained from voting, stating that he did not think the letter would accomplish anything. Far from resigning or apologizing, Supervisor Fletcher tweeted the Santee mayor's letter with this remark: "That moment when the city of Santee officially lost their mind." On Facebook sites devoted to Santee discussions, a few praised the council's actions, but many attacked it, noting the city's long history of racist issues, and a council member, Dustin Trotter, who reportedly co-founded Defend East County, or DEC. That's a group that was kicked off Facebook after many racist and violent posts, though it was initially formed to protect businesses after the La Mesa riot. Michael Schwartz, executive director of the San Diego County Gun Owners, posted, "Santee City Council calls for Nathan Fletcher's resignation in an extremely well-written letter. Thank you to all the city council members who voted for this." James Allen Jones wrote, "Does not agreeing with Newsom's agenda or the way he's handling COVID make you a white supremacist?" And Daniel Balcom replied to Fletcher's post with this comment: "Sir, people want to recall Governor Newsom because of his failures, from the vaccine distribution to the billions given to prisoners to the rolling blackouts." But others lambasted the Santee Council's actions as hypocritical, at the very least. Colin Cady wrote, "They ignore plenty of constituent calls and notes regarding the groups that actually represent hate and violence in Santee." Jason Hook stated, "This city council has not condemned DEC or any of the violent behavior in the city of Santee." Another poster wondered why the council asked for Fletcher's resignation but never called for Congressman Duncan Hunter to resign after he was indicted on federal crimes. Hunter eventually pleaded guilty and resigned. On Fletcher's social media, another poster wrote, "Santee felt personally attacked, seeing how they're the right-wing terrorist capital of San Diego County." Others referred to the city as Clan T, a derisive nickname referencing the city's long history of racially motivated incidents, including shoppers in Santee recently photographed wearing a KKK hood and mask with swastikas, as well as violent altercations between racial justice protesters and counter-protesters, some wearing Confederate flags as they taunted protesters, and in some cases waged physical assaults caught on video. The city has taken some steps to address racial issues, including its recent adoption of a campaign promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. But the reactions provoked by the council's letter serve as evidence that the city still has a long way to go to restore the public trust on racial equity issues. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The California Public Utilities Commission meets to vote on contracts for more power generation to avoid a repeat of last summer's blackouts. But clean energy groups are saying it's unclear how much energy we need because they feel the state's explanations for the outages are insufficient. The California Independent System Operator, known as CAISO, blamed the blackouts primarily on excessive heat, breakdowns at power plants, and software issues. But Loretta Lynch, former head of the California Public Utilities Commission, says there's more to the story.
It may well be that defects in California's electricity market design and in its operations have allowed for trading strategies that created artificial supply shortages, and that those caused last summer's blackouts.
Some fear a repeat of the energy crisis of 2000, when oil companies managed to manipulate the state's electricity market, costing billions. Data show that last August, huge price spikes rocked the California energy market, sending it shooting up from $40 to $1,000 per megawatt hour. Rick Humphreys is a retired engineer and an expert in root cause analysis. He says consumers are stuck with the bill.
It's well over $1 billion of cost that's going to get passed on to the ratepayers in CAISO, and that's a wholesale.
The agency admits that a software glitch allowed energy to be exported to other states during California's greatest hour of need. Humphreys says that's what put California over the edge.
There's lots of excess capacity in the state of California. If it hadn't been for the exports, there would have been no blackouts.
CAISO's policy is to hold back reserve power in case a nuclear plant goes down, and this was not changed even during the blackouts when 3 natural gas-powered plants went offline. Retired public interest lawyer Bill Julian wants lawmakers to force CAISO and the Public Utilities Commission to dig deeper.
We have a troubling pattern of forced outages and power plant unavailability that strains supplies and requires investigation.
Advocates also want the PUC to require SoCal Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, and San Diego Gas and Electric to share data from smart meters with local governments that have community choice energy programs. The idea is that with better information on usage, CAISO might be able to avoid unnecessary blackouts. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
State Senator Brian Jones, who represents East County, has introduced Senate Bill 358, a measure to increase penalties on porch pirates, thieves who steal packages outside other people's homes. Because of the COVID-19 crisis, home delivery of goods has increased all across the nation. In particular, seniors and disabled Californians rely on package delivery for fundamental items such as medication and food. Senator Jones says, quote, "Unfortunately, package theft continues to run rampant with the rise of home delivery services. This porch piracy epidemic is serious and must be addressed by our criminal justice system. While current law is weak, this bill will ensure the punishment fits the crime," end quote. Theft of a package from the porch or entryway of a home is a misdemeanor under current law, no matter how many repeat convictions the perpetrator may have on their record. Senate Bill 358 would allow prosecutors to charge the porch pirate with a misdemeanor or with a felony after the third conviction in a 36-month period. This will increase jail time for repeat offenders. According to Senator Jones, quote, "Because current law treats package theft outside the home different than burglaries inside the home, many of these porch pirates are habitual offenders who keep dodging real punishment for their crimes. In addition to driving up the price for all consumers, porch piracy leaves the most vulnerable in our community without essential items that many need to survive," end quote. Senate Bill 358 is awaiting assignment to a Senate Policy Committee for a hearing. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Alexa Oslowski.
The fight against food apartheid in California got a boost this week as the Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors voted to create a food justice roundtable to explore ways to reduce hunger and make healthy food more accessible. One program doing just that is called Market Match, which gives people who qualify for food assistance programs such as CalFresh, Pandemic EBT, or WIC an extra $10 to spend at farmers markets. Valeria Velasquez-Dueñas works with Sustainable Economic Enterprises, known as CLA, which runs multiple farmers markets. She says poverty, worsened by the pandemic, has driven a lot more customers to use Market Match.
There have been lines of people wrapped around the block at some markets to get the incentive, whereas before it used to be just like a pretty steady flow of traffic.
Some markets have privately funded programs that extend the match up to $20 per month. The food justice movement aims to make fresh produce more affordable and thus more accessible to everyone. According to the LA Food Policy Council, low-income communities of color have 2 to 3 times fewer options for healthy food compared with more affluent areas. Samira Saba, also with CLA, says Market Match also drives business to small-scale local farmers, improves people's health, and stimulates economic activity in low-income neighborhoods.
Food should be at the center of our culture and our economy, and we should really value it and make sure that everyone has that fundamental human right to healthy, fresh produce that's accessible and local to them.
To find the closest farmers market that offers the Market Watch program, go to fmfinder.org. According to the California Association of Food Banks, about 10 million people in California struggle to put food on the table. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Alexa Oslowski with a public service announcement from the County of San Diego. 95% of all San Diegans who have died from COVID-19 had underlying medical conditions, and hypertension or high blood pressure was a primary underlying condition. Hypertension also puts people at an increased risk for heart disease and stroke, two of the top causes of death in the region. 59% of San Diegans have hypertension. That's why county leaders encourage you to get a blood pressure screening and make sure that you are not suffering from hypertension, which is often referred to as the, quote, silent killer, because it may show no symptoms. 10 years ago, the county launched the Love Your Heart campaign, an annual public health event that offers people an opportunity to get their blood pressure checked at hundreds of locations in San Diego and Mexico. Last year, more than 56,000 people got their blood pressure checked at Love Your Heart sites in the United States and Mexico, which joined the campaign in 2015. This year, due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the number of sites offering blood pressure screenings will be limited, but the campaign will last an entire week, from February 8th through February 14th. Thanks to the San Diego Foundation, 6,000 low-income families in the region will also receive blood pressure cuffs to monitor their blood pressure numbers at home in an effort to address health inequalities. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says it's important to know your blood pressure, adding, quote, "Being proactive can save your life and help you protect you from the worst COVID-19 outcomes if you do become infected, including an extended hospitalization in the intensive care unit," end quote. You can find out where to get your blood pressure screening by visiting loveyourheartsd.org, where you can also get information on educational online workshops during February. You can also share your results to receive a face mask and hand sanitizer while supplies last. Again, the website to find blood pressure screenings near you, share results, or learn about online heart health programs is loveyourheartsd.org.
Helix Water District Board President Joel Scalziti wants to move public board meetings from 5 p.m. to 2 p.m. The issue will be on the agenda on Wednesday, February 17th. Scalziti was an early advocate of moving meetings from the evenings to 2 p.m. in hopes of increasing public participation. But 4 years later, both Scalziti and General Manager Carlos Lugos say the change in participation levels proved only minimal. Now with Zoom, people can access meetings on computers or cell phones, even while at work or working from home. With meetings dragging on late into the evening, Scalziti told East County Magazine, "I think it's important for staff members along with us, as well as the community members, to be able to go home and have dinner with our families." Now, in the past, some members ran on a campaign platform of moving meetings later so that working people could participate. That includes Mark Grasick and Dan McMillan, who both voted to move meetings later after their elections. But at the most recent board meeting, McMillan voiced support for shifting the time back to 2 p.m. He did not respond to our email request for comment by today's show taping deadline. Grasick objects to the change, however. He says, "Any working person or family won't be able to attend, and if you're trying to work at home, your kids might be trying to attend Zoom classes on the computer." But Scalziti says most people have multiple devices and could access meetings via a cell phone if they're working at home and their child needs the computer for schoolwork. Scalziti says the advent of Zoom during the pandemic has made meetings more accessible for all, and he plans to continue broadcasting meetings over Zoom even after the pandemic is lifted and in-person meetings can resume. Both Lugos and Scalziti say that meeting times will be changed to evenings if needed to maximize public participation and transparency on controversial items such as proposed rate hikes. Scalziti says absolutely this will be done. Lugos said the district plans to also reach out to customers through community meetings, which will be staggered at different times of day to accommodate people with different work schedules. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea. Public interest news for our region.
California's state parks have reopened campgrounds, although some other facilities remain closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Here in San Diego County, you can now go camping again in Cuyamaca Rancho State Park, Anzuperego Desert State Park, Palomar Mountain, San Pascual Battlefield, and several state beach campgrounds. You can find information on each of these parks and to make a campground reservation online at parks.ca.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Each year, the town of Julian comes alive with the sounds of music, fiddle music, along with banjos, guitars, mandolins, and mountain dulcimers at the annual Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest. Recently, we're seeing a revival of interest in the art of fiddling and, more broadly, a renaissance in traditional music both regionally and nationally. Avery Ellisman is the district representative from the California State Old Time Fiddlers Association, which started 40 years ago. Locally, there are now around 60 members on a mission to enhance appreciation for and involvement in old time fiddling. He says there's been a huge bump in sales of acoustic instruments nationally. According to the National Association of Music Manufacturers, and locally, Two major nationally known musical instrument manufacturers, Taylor Guitar and Deering Banjo, are both adding staff here in East County. Baby boomers have the money and the time to rediscover the joys of just fiddling around, a pastime that evokes bygone days when life was simpler and the pace of living was slower, with time to listen, learn, and make some music of your own. Ellisman says of fiddling, "This is the music of the people," adding, "One person sits with and teaches another." Fiddling is most prevalent in rural areas, also a popular pastime to while away time during inclement weather. It's what people did for entertainment, kids, long before the advent of radio, TV, or the internet. Ellisman says, "I consider music to be one of the highest forms of human celebration, a celebration of life. Fiddle music is infectious in a very positive way. The world needs more of that." Though played on the same instrument as a violin, he adds, "Fiddle music calls you to dance." Julian's old-time fiddle and pickin' contest has its roots in a Julian banjo and fiddle competition that started over 60 years ago. For many years, it was run by the Julian Lions Club. But as the club's membership aged, interest in hosting competitions waned. The focus shifted to entertainment, and eventually the event dwindled. Ellisman runs the Julian Family Fiddle Camp each spring to teach fiddling skills to the next generation. So he asked the Lions to partner with his group and the State Old-Time Fiddlers Association, but, he says, the Lions declined. So Ellisman turned to the community instead, asking the local Chamber of Commerce and local merchants to support a new and revitalized competition. The community agreed, and the competition has grown ever since. It's now a two-day event, encouraging visitors to spend the night and help boost Julian's local economy. Ellisman calls Julian the jewel of East County, noting that the event draws people from across the West and as far away as Alaska. The first modern-day Julian Fiddle and Pickin' contest was held in 2014. Fiddling refers to bowed instruments, while picking is for unbowed instruments such as the guitar, mandolin, banjo, and mountain dulcimer. Ellisman notes proudly, "We have kids from age 6 up to age 86, and they're playing together. It's a wonderful way to bridge the generations." Before, Julian's events were not traditional fiddle contests, but now they are. Each competitor must perform three elements, a hoedown, a waltz, and a piece of the musician's choice, such as a jig, a polka, or something else. Competitors can compete in age-based categories or in an open competition that any age can enter. The open competition is considered the premier event, with bragging rights for winners who beat all comers. At the 2016 competition, Ellisman's 16-year-old daughter, Shira Ellisman, competed for the first time in the open competition category. Early in the day, youngsters competed, and then in the afternoon, the open picking competition was held, followed by the open fiddling division. Announcer Dwight Warden explained that the history of fiddling goes back to the 1700s in America. Thomas Jefferson was an avid fiddler. Fiddling gained popularity again in the 1900s, thanks to Henry Ford, who liked fiddling so much he had fiddle competitions in all of his dealerships. But then fiddling events shifted to hokum and show fests, with people playing fiddles behind their heads or beating on instruments with broom straws, Warden recalls. More recently, the pendulum has shifted back to traditional fiddling styles that popularized the genre to begin with. In the 1950s, a major competition in Idaho put the focus back on musicianship, and the modern fiddle competition was born. All three pieces must be played within just 4 minutes, and no hokum is allowed. Shira Ellisman opened up the fiddling competition playing Sally Johnson for her hoedown entry, followed by Morning Star Waltz and Don't Let Your Gal Go Down. And here's a little bit of what this talented fiddler sounded like. The local teenager's teacher is Luke Price, a graduate of the Berklee School of Music, who is also a two-time winner of the National Fiddle Championship. After Shira was finished, the announcer exclaimed, "She's got a future ahead of her!" The competition was stiff, with many other talented performers. After the contest, three of the fiddle judges also performed, Matthew Hartz and Luke Price, both multiple national fiddle competition winners, and Mabel Vogt from Idaho. Hartz told the crowd, "I'm excited to be here and come before a group that's so supportive. For us to carry this music and art form forward, we need your support," he added, as some in the crowd offered up donations or purchased CDs. Hartz performed Festival Waltz and Shuck in the Bush to a wildly enthusiastic crowd. Here's a little excerpt of this dual national champions performance. Finally, the long-awaited announcement of the awards winners came. First, the junior winners were announced, and then the open competitors. Tom Dillon of La Mesa, who plays with a bluegrass band, took first place in the open picking category. Then, the open fiddling winner was announced, and Shira Ellison claimed the top prize, beaming from ear to ear. Afterwards, her teacher, Luke Price, shared with us how he first got interested in music. "My dad started me on guitar and banjo at 3 years old," he said, in between signing autographs from his fans. "I started classical violin at age 8. It took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre." He said, adding, "It took me 2 years before I started exploring the fiddle genre." He's come a long way since then, passing along the skills and joy of old-time fiddling to a new generation, including Shira Ellison, as she commences her own musical journey. You can learn fiddling and picking skills locally by signing up through julianfiddlecamp.com and listen to the talented local and national competitors at the next Julian Fiddle and Pickin' Contest by visiting sandiegofiddler.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, this is Miriam Raftery. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.